And this is KPFT Houston. Stay tuned for Takes in the World with Jeffrey Blankfort. He's going to be live on the phone with us for a little while.
And people are dead and dying, and it's very serious. And as much as I want to look ahead, and we will work together on a myriad of issues, it's hard for me to let go of this war because people are still dying. And you have not laid out an exit strategy, and you don't seem to be willing to, A, admit a mistake, or give any indication of what you're going to do to forcefully involve others. I am deeply troubled.
I am more than aware of the stakes, and I would hope that we can have this conversation and discuss what happened before and what went on before and what I said without impugning my credibility or my integrity. September 11th, 2001 was a defining moment for our nation and for the world. Under the vision and leadership of President Bush, our nation has risen to meet our time, fighting tyranny and securing the blessings for a new generation. A balance of power in the world that favors American diplomacy to help create the time for now. I am humbled by the great work of leading American diplomacy at such a moment in President Bush's confidence in me to undertake behind American foreign policy to support our friends. It is a time to reflect on this challenge, and I do so humbly.
And my first question is, did your outfit write a report suggesting how many military forces would be needed in Iraq?
4 years ago, Secretary Powell addressed this committee for the same purpose that I do now. Then as now,
well,
I would hope
Barbara Boxer certainly made the news, and
discuss what
both sides of the political spectrum seem to
went on before.
I think we have the second coming of
without,
Che here.
Impugning my credibility.
Here to talk about Barbara Boxer and people like Dianne Feinstein. If you don't know who Dianne Feinstein is, she would be that person
so
who was sitting
today
next to Condoleezza Rice, kind of did the introduction if you were watching that on television. And I thought she was going to break out into a chorus of California Girls or something, but she's always been kind of a right winger for a Democrat. But Barbara Boxer, so what's up with her?
Senator,
I think you're on the air. Jeff.
Hey, hi, Scooter.
Hey, give us the rundown. You're from California. You probably know all about this.
Yes, I'm not particularly proud of it a good part of the time because, unfortunately, both Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein for years have been given a pass by what passes for the left in that Barbara Boxer is now being held as a second coming. First, of course, she was the only senator to set forth an attempt to stop the vote in Ohio, and you know that's what a lot of folks should have done. Unfortunately, all this and it was important to try and deal with the Ohio vote, but a whole city of Fallujah was destroyed. And there was no protest around that. People were focusing more on the elections. But getting on with this, her questioning of Condoleezza Rice, which if you didn't know anything about Barbara Boxer, you'd say, this woman has a lot of courage. This woman has a lot of guts. Let's get behind her. Maybe even have her run for president in 4 years. But Barbara Boxer's record doesn't stand scrutiny. Last year, for example, she was a co-sponsor with Rick Santorum, one of those right-wing demagogues in the Senate, who she had battled on abortion issues, but linked arms with on something called the Syria Accountability and Lebanese Sovereignty Restoration Act, which passed by an 89-4 vote in the Senate last year. And this is Barbara Boxer's plan. This is to do the same thing to Syria.
Was she co-sponsoring this, or?
Yeah, she co-sponsored as a Democrat with Rick Santorum as a Republican. And this, you would think from this Syria Accountability Act, which was in fact drafted by the Israel lobby, by AIPAC, that Syria was a threat to the United States. And so this was to sanction Syria, because Syria is evidently is supporting acts of international terrorism and has developed weapons of mass destruction. And the real target, of course, is Syria's support of Hezbollah, which is a Lebanese resistance organization that developed in the wake of Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, which cost 20,000 lives, which Congressman Boxer at the time, vocally supported. And so this bill called on the Secretary of State, which is now going to be Condoleezza, to list Syria as a state sponsor of terrorism until Syria ends its support for terrorism, including its support of Hezbollah and other terrorist groups in Lebanon, and its hosting of terrorist groups in Damascus, and comes into full compliance with U.S. law relating to terrorism and U.N. Security Council resolution of September 28, 2001. And they compare in this case that Hezbollah is equally or more capable than Al-Qaeda. Now, her sponsorship of this bill was totally ignored by the people who are now praising her and who are supposedly of the left. And so suddenly she is everybody's darling. She also, over the years, besides getting $250,000 from the pro-Israeli lobby political action committees, she has been raided by a couple of groups, one called Jews for Peace in Palestine and Israel, another called the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, and they rate the Congress people, the senators, from a plus five to a minus five. In 2001 to 2002, Senator Boxer had a minus five. We couldn't go any lower than that. On the other hand, you have a group called Peace Action, gave her 100% rating, which means they didn't include or care for any of the resolutions that she had voted on, which totally supported Israel.
So they gave her 100%, but they left out the Middle East?
Yeah.
That's great.
But when it comes to the Middle East, only a few people like Tom Lantos, who can be considered an agent for Israel. In fact, he goes abroad to Israel, to countries where Israel has no diplomatic recognition and represents Israel to those countries. Like he threatens them what's going to happen if they don't comply. This was in the Jerusalem Post.
But okay, so who's Tom Lantos again?
Tom Lantos is a congressman from South San Francisco and San Mateo, which is immediately south of San Francisco. He's one of the people who organized the phony incubator baby story back in 1991.
Is this guy a Democrat?
Yeah, he's a Democrat, and he is totally supported by the Labor Council in San Francisco, and the only demonstration against him is one that I organized just before 9/11, which got minimal support from the ordinary left groups that are out opposing the war, like ANSWER. So what we have here is a Democratic Party across the board, from Feinstein to Boxer to Lantos, getting a free pass in an area that's supposed to be the heart of the radical revolutionary struggle in the United States. Well, it may have been one time, but it certainly is not anymore.
Yeah, we're still waiting to find out where that is.
It may not be within the 48 or the 50.
I don't know. Maybe it'll start in Kansas.
At this point, Feinstein's an interesting case because she has never been an ideologue, never been a picky Zionist. She had never gone to Israel when she became the mayor, which she actually made a mistake and went over to Leningrad and came back to San Francisco announcing, this is before Perestroika, that San Francisco had become a sister city with Leningrad, and she never heard the kinds of attacks that she got in San Francisco because this, you know, having a deal with the Ruskies, and then people said, you've never been to Israel. So what had happened is she immediately broke the deal with Leningrad and went over to Haifa and made Haifa the sister city with San Francisco. So Feinstein's role is kind of like more of a Republican, but not particularly an ideologue, more of an opportunist. Whereas Boxer plays this kind of radical role when it comes to issues like the ones we've seen here, or against the war, but in fact, no comment about the kind of aid that's gone to Israel, or the role the neocons have played in orchestrating the current war.
Well, I would, one thing about Feinstein, though, is she's a extremely vicious drug warrior. I mean, she's to the right of Orrin Hatch on that stuff.
Yes.
She's very rough in that. I mean, she's just a Nazi in that. I remember Jello Biafra came in fourth when he ran against her when I was living there. And so I know our audience probably knows Jello Biafra, so.
Jello Biafra, right.
Yeah. But at least his campaign parties were a lot more fun.
A lot louder. Yeah, she's actually a very straight lady.
We used to call her the Dragon Lady.
Right, and that she fits within the Democratic Party. Art Torres, who's one of the leading members of the state Senate, when asked about the difference between Feinstein's approach to Condoleezza Rice, introducing her, and Boxer attacking her, he said, well, this is a Democratic Party, and there's room for both. And that's why there's not room for you or me. And most of the people I know. But in any case, Boxer, actually, I go back with Boxer a long way. I used to live in Marin years ago, and I had actually worked for the County Medical Society. And a friend of mine, who a Japanese-American woman, she was actually Japanese, who was a survivor from Hiroshima, was an outskirts of town when the bomb dropped. She ran against Barbara Boxer back in the early 80s for the Board of Supervisors of Marin County and just lost. She ran as a liberal Republican. And Boxer took off from there, and then, of course, made her support of Israel very clear, and that's the reason $250,000 has come to her just from PACs alone, not individual contributions. So she is one of the very strong supporters of Israel within the Congress. So her opposition to the war and question of Condoleezza Rice has to be looked in that context.
Well, it was interesting.
Now, it was interesting to hear that discussion, and then of course you have Joe Biden, who represents DuPont. I don't know how many people have ever been in Delaware, but I think you could cross it with about 10-minute run.
Right.
And you never see any stories from Delaware come out of Delaware other than stories about Joe Biden. Interesting story about Delaware is that following the death of murder of Martin Luther King, they had to call the National Guard out in, I think, Williamsburg, Delaware. I forget the town, Williamsburg. In any case, they called the National Guard out because it was a black ghetto that was up in arms. 8 years later, the National Guard was still there. And there was never any stories on it in the national press.
The National Guard was still there doing what? Standing around on the...
Guarding the good burghers of Williamsburg against the people in the black ghetto.
So but I guess
if you notice, Delaware is never in the news, other than Biden, who is always spouting off, saying, I love you, I love you, I love you, to Alberto Gonzalez. and then questioning Condoleezza Rice and saying, I'm going to vote for you, you see.
Right.
It's a situation for those people who still think electoral politics offers possibilities of change, or working within the Democratic Party is the way to go. All they have to look over is a trail of betrayals over the last 40, 50 years. No, that's not going to work.
Well, I don't know what we're going to do if these people that were at these rubber stamp hearings are the opposition. I mean, phew.
Well, the problem is suddenly out here, Boxer is literally being hailed unequivocally as the hero of our times. And yeah. So in the consciousness, at least in the 60s, in the late 60s, people recognized that Democrats and Republicans were both responsible. And we saw that in the Democratic Convention in 68. Now, people still think, John Kerry would have been somehow different had he been elected. But, he made this promise before he was elected, before he ran for office, before the election, that if he became president, he would get 40,000 more troops over to Iraq.
Right.
And since that time, now he lost, but he put in a bill in Congress to get 40,000 more troops sent to Iraq.
And that was one of the main things he was hammering Condoleezza on, too.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, so people have also said, well, look, Kerry voted against her as well. But Kerry was approaching Iraq from a totally different position.
Right.
And so this is what we're left with. We're left with the equivalent of what's that, Chucky, as a Secretary of State. I saw the pictures of, you know, Chucky?
No.
It's one of these horror movies.
Oh, okay, yeah.
A little doll named Chucky.
Right, right, right.
If you look at the pictures of Condoleezza Rice, she's very much like Chucky.
She does have a kind of weird look, kind of scary look about her.
She has a scary look, and we know a Secretary of State, she's going to make Colin Powell seem like, well, I can't imagine Secretary of State we've had, but Colin Powell, who probably was the most instrumental person in getting this war finally happening, because he was like the front man. He was the person, he was the good executive officer.
Right, they put the good cop up to tell the big lies.
The good cop up to tell the big lies. Of course, he should have resigned after the exposures, but nobody resigned.
He should have resigned and not done it, you know?
Actually, but he has a history going back to covering up a me lie. So, I mean, he's a good soldier.
Yeah, I that's right. Yeah, I remember that. Hey, look, we got to get on with your interview here. Now, this is the guy that wrote the
Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins, a very interesting guy. It's a book I well recommend. Perkins was one of these people who was working for a low-profile engineering group that went down into Latin America to get these governments, in Indonesia, to get governments to buy expensive construction projects that they couldn't afford, to take out the loans, which now account for this gross, this incredible international debt that third world countries have and can never pay.
Okay,
and when countries didn't play along with them,
we got to get to it.
CIA.
We got to get to it. So, Jeffrey Blankford, thanks a lot for joining us live and giving us the inside scoop. What, boxer or just sparring partner?
All right.
Thanks,
take
Jeffrey.
Take care.
Listeners, the Democracy Now! Program heard Amy Goodman interviewing investigative journalist Seymour Hersh concerning his latest expose in the current issue of The New Yorker. And Hersh writes that George Bush's re-election was not his only victory. The president and his national security advisors have consolidated control over the military and intelligence community's strategic analyses and covert operations to a degree unmatched since the rise of the post-Second World War national security state. Bush, writes Hersh, has an aggressive and ambitious agenda for using that control against the mullahs in Iran and against targets in the ongoing war on terrorism during a second term. The CIA will continue to be downgraded, he says, and the agency will increasingly serve as one government consultant with close ties to the Pentagon, put it, as, quote, facilitators of policy emanating from President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. This process is well underway. Despite the deteriorating security, writes Hersh, situation in Iraq, the Bush administration has not reconsidered its basic long-range policy goal in the Middle East, the establishment of democracy throughout the region. Hopefully, Hersh wrote that last line with tongue-in-cheek, as a cover for revealing that U.S. Special Forces have been inside Iran, scouting Iran's alleged nuclear facilities in advance of launching airstrikes to destroy them. That Bush or anyone in his administration has any desire to see democracy anywhere on the planet or even knows what the term means would be hard to prove, although it is mantra that the mainstream media and even Hersh in this instance seem obliged to feed us. What Bush's return to the White House represents, as much as all the other negatives we have heard, is a triumph of the neocons, the boys from Project for the New American Century, who ordered up the war in Iraq, got us into that quagmire, and have yet to pay any political price. What also was interesting was Hersh's acknowledgement of the sentiment in Washington that the current war in Iraq is being fought for Israel, a charge I made in an article I wrote last year for Left Curve magazine. It was entitled A War for Israel, and you could find it by going to leftcurve.org and scrolling down to issue number 28, or simply by Googling A War for Israel with my name. The war in Iraq was driven by the neocons, but it had the full backing of the pro-Israel lobby, and the demand for regime change in Iran and Syria is also at the top of the lobby's agenda. The American Jewish Committee, one of the oldest of the American Jewish organizations, has been very active over the years in lobbying foreign governments in behalf of Israel. It is not surprising that the director of its Middle East office, Eran Lerman, is a former Israeli intelligence operative. Here is how he beats the drums for attacking Iran and Syria in a special briefing he sent to subscribers to the organization's website yesterday. Quote, "It is Iran and Syria indeed," he wrote, "who now not only host the terror groups responsible for the escalation in both Israel and Iraq, but train and supply them, finance them lavishly, in the case of Iran, and prod them ever further, demanding, quote-unquote, results," end quote. From their point of view, he writes, "the dual threats of Iraqi stabilization and Palestinian progress, exemplified by the elections in both places, are a mortal challenge. They are not wrong, I believe, in feeling that present American project in the region, if brought to fruition, would put an end to the totalitarian methods of governance, the Ba'ath as well as the Khomeini versions represented by these two allied regimes. Hence the sense of urgency they feel and the use of terror as a key tool of statecraft." That's Eran Lerman from the Middle East office of the American Jewish Committee and a former member of Israeli intelligence. Ironically, but not surprisingly, he fails to acknowledge the use of terror is a key tool of statecraft by both the U.S. and Israel, not to mention how Iran manages to train Palestinian fighters inside the sealed-off West Bank and Gaza. He doesn't tell how that takes place. If there is a U.S. attack on Iran or Syria, it will be done in behalf of the Sharon regime as well. Neither country presents any threat to U.S. interests. Well, on that subject, here's a story I don't believe you have heard, namely that an Israeli oil company has been awarded a lucrative contract to supply the U.S. Army in Iraq. According to IsraelNationalNews.com, the tender was awarded to Sunol Gasoline Company and is valued at $70 to $80 million. The company is expected to supply the U.S. forces with 25 million liters of fuel monthly. The tender was issued by a subsidiary of Halliburton, the U.S.-based Kellogg Brown & Root Company, which has been given the lion's share of U.S. military contracts in Iraq. The fuel, which Israel imports, will pass through the fuel terminal operated by the Sashan Oil and Energy Infrastructure Company and be transported by train across Israel and Jordan to Iraq. Industry experts are baffled why Israel has been chosen for the deal when Turkey supplied northern Iraq with about 300,000 metric tons of gas over the course of 6 months last year, a deal estimated at $70 to $80 million. According to the Energy Information Administration, Israel produces almost no oil and imports nearly all its oil needs. Meanwhile in Iraq, with the elections just 11 days away, a report I received yesterday was quite chilling. "The U.S. soldiers are doing strange things in Fallujah," according to the report, said an eyewitness. "In the center of the Julan quarter, they are removing entire homes which have been bombed. Meanwhile, most of the homes that were bombed are left as they were. Why are they doing this?" According to this source, such a removal was also done in the Nizal, Mulamin, Jubail, and Shuhada districts in late November. The same source said he watched the U.S. military use bulldozers to push the soil into piles and load it onto trucks to carry away. This was done in the quarters of the city where resistance was the fiercest during the siege. "At least 2 kilometers of soil were removed," the source explained, "exactly as they did at Baghdad Airport after the heavy battles there during the invasion, and the Americans used their special weapons," perhaps referring to depleted uranium or napalm and white phosphorus, both of which have been reported as having been used in Fallujah by some in the mainstream press. In certain areas where the U.S. used those special munitions, 200 square meters of soil is reportedly removed from each blast site. In addition, there are reports that the U.S. military brought in water tanker trucks to power blast the streets. "They went around to every house and have shot the water tanks," the source continued, "as if they are trying to hide the evidence of chemical weapons in the water, but they only did this in some areas." Last week, the Guardian of London, citing a damning report released by the British Museum, noted that troops from the U.S.-led force in Iraq have caused widespread damage and severe contamination to the remnants of the ancient city of Babylon. The city has been used by U.S. and Polish forces as a military depot for the past 2 years, despite objections from archaeologists. This is tantamount to establishing a military camp around the Great Pyramid in Egypt, or around Stonehenge in Britain, according to the report. Somebody had tried to gouge out the decorated bricks forming the famous dragons of the Ishtar Gate, and a 2,600-year-old brick pavement has been crushed by U.S. military vehicles, leaving archaeological fragments scattered across the site. The U.S. military defended its operations, but said all earth-moving projects had been stopped, and it was considering moving troops away to protect what's left of the ruins. And regarding those elections, Robert Fisk writes from Baghdad, the real trouble is not so much the violence that will take place before, during, and rest assured after 30 January. The greatest threat to democracy is that with four provinces containing around half the population of Iraq in a state of insurgency and many of its towns under rebel control, this election is going to widen the differences between the Sunnis, Shias, and Kurds in a way that not even Saddam Hussein was able to achieve. If the Sunnis don't vote, save for those living in America, Syria, and other exotic locations, writes Fisk, in the Shia community, perhaps 60% of the population will take an overwhelming number of seats in the traditional transitional National Assembly. In other words, the Shia who are not fighting the U.S. occupation of Iraq will be voting under American auspices, while the Sunnis who are fighting will refuse to participate in what the insurgents have already labeled a quisling election. The 4 million Kurds will vote, but however many seats they gain, they are not going to abandon their quasi-independence after the election. Thus, the dangers of civil war, so trumpeted by the Americans and British, may be increased rather than suppressed by this much-touted experiment in democracy. Thus writes Robert Fisk in Monday's London Independent. It's interesting to note that Fisk thought before that there would be no civil war in Iraq. But now on the scene, he sees what the U.S. invasion and occupation has created, the coming apart of Iraq and perhaps a long civil war. In the West Bank and Gaza, where they had another election 10 days ago, the honeymoon between Ariel Sharon and Mohammed Abbas, the Palestinian Authority's newly elected president, has predictably chilled. Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen, is ready and willing to collaborate with Sharon against the interests of his own people. But Sharon, the Israeli army on one side, and the Palestinian resistance on the other, won't let him. Despite his public outreach to Abbas, Sharon's occupying army continued its operations against Palestinian fighters in both the West Bank and Gaza, raiding their homes and shooting them in the streets. Predictably, the Palestinian resistance is not about to lay down their weapons while they are still a target of the Israelis, and Israelis are still occupying their land. If Abbas cannot stop the attacks on Gaza and the Israeli border town is Sderot, Sharon has threatened a massive attack with no restrictions against the people of Gaza. That will mean mass killing, an activity in which Sharon has proved to be a past master. And we hear this morning that the Palestinian security officers are supposed to station themselves at the Gaza border, but to stop Palestinian attacks on Gaza and Israel, but the Israelis have committed to nothing in terms of stopping attacks on the Palestinians, both Gaza and the West Bank. At the same time, the Sharon government is asking for a special $180 million aid package from the U.S. to pay for what, in Orwellian terms, it describes as a quality of life plan for the Palestinian residents in the West Bank whose lives have been negatively affected by the construction of what the Israelis call a separation barrier and the Palestinians the apartheid wall. The money would be earmarked for building passages through the barrier, equipped with special advanced equipment for x-raying belongings and other special technology meant, according to the Israelis, to ease the transit of people and goods. Although the money would go to Israel, Bush administration officials were told that the U.S. could consider it aid to the Palestinians without fear of the money leaking out of Palestinian Authority coffers to terrorist groups. Israel's planning 3 to 5 passages along the barrier and has also asked the World Bank to help finance their construction and the technologies that will be positioned in the passages. An earlier report said the World Bank, which unlike Washington, is not under the thumb of the Israel lobby, has refused on the basis that this wall is built in occupied territory. It is now 15 minutes past the hour. Let's listen to one of Tom Lehrer's last recordings called Selling Out. He recorded this in New York in October 1999 while I get John Perkins on the telephone. Stay tuned.
Selling out is easy to do. It's not so hard to find a buyer for you. When money talks, you're under its spell. Ah, but what do you have when there's nothing left to sell? Selling out.
I'd rather call it compromise.
It's easy to do.
Sometimes you have to close your eyes.
It's not so hard.
Being rich is no disgrace.
To find a buyer for you.
Put on your shoes and join the race.
When money talks,
it has a very soothing voice.
You're under its spell.
It's up to you to make the choice.
Ah, but what
before
do you
know
have
it,
when
be
there's nothing left to sell? You can't always break the rules. People who try are fools. When you get older, maybe then you will see. I've always found ideals don't take the place of meals. That's how it is and how it will always be. It's so nice to have integrity. I'll tell you why. If you really have integrity, it means your price is very high. So remember when you start to preach and moralize, that we all are in the game, and brother, its name is compromise. It's so nice
selling
to have integrity.
I'll tell you why.
Sometimes you have to close your eyes. It's not so hard.
Tom Lehrer, Selling Out, 1999. From 1971 to 1981, John Perkins worked for the international consulting firm Charles T. Main, where he held the title of Chief Economist and Manager of Economics and Regional Planning. Unless you've read his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, you've probably never heard of that company, and that's no accident. You weren't supposed to. And the title belies what Perkins' role actually was, an EHM, or economic hitman. Today he is the founder and president of the Dream Change Coalition, which works closely with Amazonian and other indigenous people to help preserve their environments and cultures, trying to give something back from what he had earlier helped to take away. His book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, published by Barrett and Kohler in San Francisco, is an eye-opener into the workings of what he calls a corporatocracy. Welcome, John Perkins, to Take on the World.
Thanks, Jeff. It's great to be with you.
Well, coming on the eve of the corporatocracy's second coronation of George W. Bush, this seems an appropriate moment to talk about that concept and what it means. Is this a case that while the ordinary Americans go about their lives believing that they live in a somewhat flawed democracy, what we have, in fact, running our country, our lives, and, in fact, the world is something quite different?
That's absolutely true. That's what I wanted to point out in the book. We have created the world's first truly global empire. We've created it largely without the military and without an emperor or a king. And contrary to what some people may be thinking, not even a family that runs this country. This empire has been created under democratic regimes as well as Republican. It's been created by what I call the corporatocracy, which, are relatively few men and a few women who move at the highest levels of corporations, government, and banks. They move back and forth between those three organizations all the time. And they've really, since World War II, used us economic hitmen to create this amazing global empire, then, and most Americans have no idea. You know, when you create an empire like the Romans did with armies, or the Spanish, or the Portuguese, or the British, or the French, or the Germans, Dutch, everybody knows you're doing it. Your young men and women are constantly going off to fight wars. When you do it through economics, it's kind of easy to hide the fact, and it's easy for all of us to kind of stick our necks in the sand and not look at what's going on.
Well, you know, the recent tsunami again raised the issue of the ponderous third world debt. It's an unpayable debt. And your book's essentially, or a great part of it, is the story of how America built its global empire and creating that debt and the role that you and other economic hitmen played in it. How did that happen, and what was your role?
Well, you're absolutely right. That's one of the main tools that economic hitmen use. It's not the only one, but it's probably the most typical. Typically what we do is identify a third world country with resources that we covet, let's say oil, that's one of them, and we arrange for a large loan to be made to that country. Usually the loan is made by the World Bank or a coalition of banks under the World Bank, and most of the money from that loan never goes to the third world country. It never leaves the United States. It's transferred from a bank in Washington to one in San Francisco or Houston or New York or Chicago, where it goes to one of our big companies that build projects in those countries, companies like the ones we hear about a lot these days, the Bechtels and the Halliburtons and others. And the projects that are built in these countries, large power plants, big highways, ports, industrial parts, primarily serve the very rich, usually don't help the poor at all, and in fact hurt the poor because they put the country deep into debt. It can't make the social payments, education payments, health care payments for the poor. And in the end, the country is left holding a huge debt that it can't repay. And so at some point, we economic hitmen go back to that country and say, look, you know, you owe us a lot of money. You can't pay your debts. So sell your oil or whatever resource real cheap to our corporations. And you've got to vote with us in the next critical UN vote and maybe give us a little land for some military bases. We demand our pound of flesh in many different ways. And that's the way we've really built this empire since World War II.
And when some governments like Panama with Omar Torrijos and Ecuador with Jaime Roldes don't go along, then what happens?
Good point, Jeff. We economic hitmen have been very successful over the last decade. But occasionally we do fail, and when we fail, what we call the jackals, who are CIA-sanctioned assassins, step in and do their job. And first they'll probably try to overthrow our government, as they did recently in Venezuela. But if they can't overthrow the government, then they may well try to assassinate the president. And that's what happened in Panama with Omar Torrijos and Ecuador with Jaime Roldos, both men I worked for. And I was very aware that I wasn't bringing them around. They were very integritous. They wanted to help their poor people. They would not buy into this system. And I liked them both very much. I was especially close to Torrijos, and I didn't want to see any harm come to them. So it was quite a challenge for me. I had an added incentive to try to corrupt them and bring them around. I couldn't. And so, sure enough, the jackal stepped in, and both men were assassinated in 1981.
Through mysterious plane crashes.
Well, yeah, they really weren't that mysterious to most of the people who were around at the time.
There's so much you cover in the book. I want to get into the role of Robert Strange McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, as he became famous during the Vietnam War, and has since written his memoirs about that war. But many people, and now you point out his role as a president of the World Bank, had even more significance in terms of the global empire building.
Absolutely. You know, McNamara, in a way, epitomizes the economic hitman. He was at the top of the economic hitman and ladder, and he very much promoted this system. And it's a good point, too, because a lot of people these days are thinking, well, this is a Republican issue, but it isn't. It happens in the Democrats as well as Republicans. McNamara was president of Ford Motor Company, became Secretary of Defense under Kennedy and Johnson, and then president of the World Bank. Again, he typifies, he represented all three branches of the corporatocracy, the big banks, the big corporations, and government, he's a good case in point of somebody who goes back and forth, which probably should be a conflict of interest that people move that often from private industry into government and back out again into the private sector. He very much promoted this way of doing business, building up these debts, bringing countries in under our fold. I think McNamara discovered, as Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War, the fallacy of military might, and he saw that there was another way to accomplish the same objective, and that was through economics, and he did it very, very successfully.
I want to get back to that second last point you made, but you noticed that he kind of introduced the revolving door between the government and the corporations, such as Bechtel and Halliburton. We've seen that with the chemical corporations like Monsanto going into the Food and Drug Administration. But we saw like the Weinbergers and the Mac and the Schultzes from Bechtel going into the government in and out.
Yes, it's really shocking, isn't it? When you think about it, if you were to read a Graham Greene novel or any novel about a country whose government was constantly composed of people from the industries that they were supposedly watchdogging, the very people who were supposed to control and make sure corruption doesn't happen in these industries become the officials in charge of the industry, and then they go back into the industry and get rewarded for not clamping down on the industry while they were in government. I mean, if you read about this in a novel in a third world country, you'd say, my God, that's a terrible banana republic. In fact, that's exactly how we operate these days. We used to have stronger laws against this. We had scandals like Teapot Dome that were around similar issues. But in this day and age, it's become very, very acceptable. We know today Dick Cheney is in that position. Condoleezza Rice is. She's going to be nominated as the next Secretary of State. I have no doubt. Maybe approved. Maybe it happened today already. I haven't been following it. But it's really a system that's just begging for corruption. These things should be a conflict of interest. No man or woman should be given those kinds of temptation that these people are given at the very top.
I know it's interesting in terms of Bechtel and Halliburton. These are privately owned corporations, and so there's no really way of finding out how they're functioning or even as stockholders becoming involved in challenging their functions.
Yes, that's particularly true of Bechtel. It's really totally controlled by the Bechtel family. And that was true of the company that I worked for. We were what's called a closely held corporation, basically a partnership, and we didn't have to divulge most of what we did. You know, the IRS demands only, very scanty numbers around these things. It's the SEC that controls these things. If you're not traded on the stock market, or if you control the majority of the votes of the stock, then you can get away with amazing things.
Now, in my introduction, I mentioned the Charles T. Maine Company that you worked for. I had never heard of it, which was, I wasn't supposed to hear about it. Perhaps you could describe how that company came about and how it worked. And is it still doing the same kind of work?
It's disappeared, which is interesting, too. It kind of got folded into another company. And after I left, while I was about leaving, a U.S. Retired Army general took over the company and under his command, it basically disappeared, which is an interesting story in and of itself. But it was a 100-year-old company when I went to work for it. We had over 2,000 employees in the consulting business. We took up, I think, 8 floors at the Prudential Center in Boston. It wasn't like we were, hiding in some cave under the ground, but we were a closely held corporation. We didn't have to divulge much about what we did. We stayed away from the press. We were very quiet about what we did. And a lot of what we did was economic hitman type stuff. Now, I will say this, that most of the employees in that company weren't really aware that that's what we were doing. They probably should have been, but they're making good money. They're not doing anything illegal. In fact, they're doing things that are praised by the business schools, by the World Bank, by reputable organizations. So it's easy when you're in that position, you're living a good life, you're making a lot of money, to kind of ignore what your heart may be telling you that what you're really doing is not helping the people that you say you're helping. This whole system, Jeff, is built on the belief among most of the American people, including a lot of people involved in this business, that foreign aid is altruistic and that it's really helping these other countries. And for the most part, that's just not true. It's not. There is some foreign aid that's altruistic. For example, when we send food and medicine and tents after a tsunami or some other crisis. But the majority of our foreign aid really goes to line the pockets of a few very wealthy people in the United States and a few very wealthy people in the third world countries. But most Americans don't realize that.
My guest is John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Getting back to that point, I remember reading, picking up in a second-hand store, a Department of State journal back in the early 60s, in which someone from the State Department was speaking to some quasi-public group, in which he said that 82% of American foreign aid comes back to the U.S. in purchases of American goods, which is, in a sense, the U.S. taxpayers subsidizing American corporations.
Well, that's, I hadn't seen that, but that was in the early 60s, that statistic?
Right. This was, it was an olive drab journal, you know, a magazine I picked up, and I said, this was extraordinary.
See, you must be as old as I am, Jeff. I'm about to turn 60.
I turned 70 last June.
Oh, wow. Well, I would never know it from your voice. Those statistics are hard to come by. Have you seen any more recent ones?
No, I haven't. I was amazed by that.
Yeah. Well, actually, I would suspect that these days it's higher than that, although an awful lot of it gets masked. We really pull the wool over the head of the American people. I was recently in Washington, D.C., and on a live show there, and then there was some people from the World Bank who called up and said, well, you know, we invest a lot of money in building schools and hospitals. It actually isn't a lot of money as a percentage of the overall budget. But even in those cases, what's discouraging about this is that when we build schools and hospitals and other such facilities, it provides a lot of work for construction companies. Once again, it's often our construction companies that go in and build those facilities, get paid very well for that. But if we don't set up programs to train teachers and administrators and nurses and doctors and technical medical assistants, those schools and hospitals are essentially useless and sometimes worse than useless. So we really have to look beneath the lines on all of these things. It's so easy to be hoodwinked, and we've been hoodwinked. The American people have really been screwed over the last several decades.
And you find very little of this reported, even on the economic pages. Once in a while, you'll find something, but articles that should be on the front page are buried in the business section, where only people who play the market will read them when they should be obviously first front page stories.
We need to change that.
Amongst so many interesting things in the book, you went first into the Peace Corps, and before going to work for Charles Maine, and there's a suspicion among many people that the Peace Corps has been used over the years by the government, by the CIA, other agencies, for its own purposes, that this altruistic organization actually is a foothold by the U.S. in third world countries. How does that play out?
Well, I can't really say that. I don't know. What I will say is that while I was still in school, in business school in Boston, I was recruited by the National Security Agency, mainly because my father-in-law was high up in the Naval Department and one of his best friends was high in the National Security Agency, so I had an in. And they ran me through a series of tests, including very extensive lie detector tests, and they discovered that I would make that potentially I was a good economic hitman. They also discovered a lot of weaknesses in my character, flaws that could be used to hook me, to bring me in, like many people. I'm sort of, you could say I was addicted to the big drugs of our culture, of money, power, and sex, and they defined some very specific things about that. And then I was interested in the Peace Corps. I heard a Peace Corps representative speak, and I was really interested in going into the Amazon for personal reasons that I described in the book. And the people at the National Security Agency who had offered me a job encouraged me to do that. And they encouraged me and I think helped me get a job in Ecuador working with indigenous people who were opposing oil companies in the Amazon and the Andes. And today are on the front line. They've sworn war against U.S. oil companies just this year. So I got very much on the job training. While I was still there, a vice president from Charles T. Maine came down to Ecuador and contacted me and eventually, you know, brought me into the fold of Charles T. Maine. The way the system works today is economic hitmen, as far as I know, are never employed directly by the government. They were at one time. We are often identified, recruited, and even trained by organizations like the NSA or the CIA. But it's much better for the government if we work for private firms because there's no trace back to the government. The same is true, incidentally, of the jackals, of the assassins, of the people we think of as kind of the James Bond types. They no longer work for organizations like the CIA or the NSA. They work for private firms that contract out to them, so there's really no paper trail. So I made a long story out of that. I have no reason to believe that the Peace Corps itself was complicit in all of this, that they were involved in this. I don't know. It's entirely possible they were, but I have no real empirical evidence to demonstrate that.
Actually, you refer to the privatization of U.S. Policy initiatives and compare initially to the role that former CIA agent Kermit Roosevelt played in the overthrow of the government of Iran back in the early 50s.
Yeah, that he was. I'd say Kermit was really the first economic hitman, and he was also a jackal. He was sort of combined the two. 1951, Iran democratically elected Mohammad Mossadegh as premier, and this was hailed throughout the Middle East and indeed throughout the whole world as being a great movement toward democratizing the world, which we hear a lot about now these days. He was Time Magazine's Man of the Year in 51. And then he objected to the fact of what he said the oil companies were taking 85% of the money from oil, Iranian oil, out of Iran. The Iranian people needed to get more. And he threatened to nationalize the oil companies if they didn't provide more to the people. This was primarily what's today British Petroleum. The British and the American companies were incensed, of course. We decided we had to do something. It was at a period in history when we were very frightened of the Russians and the fact that they had nuclear armaments. And we didn't want to send military into this country that borders Russia, Iran. So instead we sent Kermit Roosevelt in. He was a CIA agent, grandson of Teddy Roosevelt. We sent him in with a few million dollars, and he worked a miracle, essentially, if you want to call it that. He overthrew Mossadegh and replaced him with the Shah. So he overthrew this democratically elected premier and replaced him with a despot who became, as we all know, very brutal and was very strongly in favor of helping our oil companies. From an empire-building standpoint, it was extremely successful, and suddenly the corporatocracy looked around and said, my goodness, this was cheap. It cost a few million dollars. We didn't have to risk war. We didn't have to risk American lives. This is a great deal. Only problem was Roosevelt was a CIA agent, government employee. Had he been discovered, it would have created problems. So very shortly after that, the decision was made to do the same sorts of things that he'd done, but to use private contractors to carry it out.
Well, we are living through the legacy of that today.
It's called blowback in the CIA term.
Right, and it's blowing very, very hard.
It is.
While we're in the Middle East, the section of the book that deals with the U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia is very, very revealing and very important. Following the 1973 October war between Israel, Egypt, and Syria, and the oil embargo that was the Arab countries enforced against the United States, the U.S. dramatically changed their relations with Saudi Arabia, and perhaps you could give us a bit of that. It's a very important part of the book.
It is, and it leads directly to what's happening in Iraq today.
Yes.
In the early 70s, as you may recall, we had a huge crisis here because the OPEC countries cut back on oil sales to us. And we had cars lined up at gas stations. We were afraid we were going to. This was going to send us into another depression like the one in 1929. And the Treasury Department, U.S. Treasury Department, came to me and other economic hitmen and said, you know, we've got to make sure this doesn't happen again. Well, we knew that the key to that would be Saudi Arabia, because it had more oil than anybody else, and we also knew that the royal house, the House of Saud, was corruptible and had been corrupted. So, to make a long story short, the longer version is in the book, but we reached this deal, we worked out this deal with the House of Saud that they would reinvest most of the money they made through selling oil to us, they would reinvest that back into U.S. government securities. The interest from those securities would be used by the Treasury Department to hire U.S. companies to build Saudi Arabia, to create desalinization plants, power plants, petrochemical plants, highways, and in fact, entire cities would be built out of the desert. And this has all happened.
You called it a planner's dream.
And it was part of westernizing this country, too, because we did it in a westernized way. You know, we put a lot of McDonald's and a lot of other U.S. type of things, which is one of the things that Osama bin Laden has objected to, and many Muslims have. But part of this deal also was that the House of Saud would guarantee to keep the price of oil within acceptable limits to us, and we would guarantee to keep the House of Saud in power as long as they kept their end of the bargain. And all this has been held in place now since the mid-1970s until today.
What's interesting is that subsequent to 9/11, in which the Saudis had obviously some degree of involvement, there has been an effort largely led by the neocons and their allies in the press to break the U.S.-Saudi relationship, which has been resisted. It's the only aspect of the neocon agenda that has been resisted by President Bush. And perhaps you could give some background of that.
Well, the House of Saud is in deep trouble. It's very unstable. We've seen a lot of assassinations and a lot of problems in Saudi Arabia for the first time in history, really. They've always had a tight clamp until fairly recently. One of the reasons they're in trouble is, and perhaps the main reason, is because they westernized the country. Muslims around the world hate to see the fact that Medina and Mecca are now surrounded by these westernized developments and cities. And people like Osama bin Laden are very incensed over this, the conservative Wahhabis. We've suddenly realized that we may not be able to continue to keep the House of Saud in power without sending the troops into Saudi Arabia, and maybe even if we did that, that wouldn't work either. So we're not sure it's in our best interest, which is one of the reasons I'm sure that we attacked Iraq, was to help bolster the Saudi government and also to hedge our bets in case we're not able to bolster the House of Saud. Of course, the other point about Iraq is that we were so successful in Saudi Arabia, or at least it seemed so successful to us at the time, despite the blowback we're getting today, that we thought immediately we could repeat the same model in Iraq. And so the economic hitmen went into Saddam Hussein and tried to convince him to do the same thing that the House of Saud had done. He resisted. He would not go along with it. So the jackals went in and tried to overthrow him and tried to assassinate him. They were unsuccessful. He had very loyal bodyguards, and in fact, he had so many doubles that most of his bodyguards sometimes didn't even know who they were really guarding. And so when both the economic hitmen and the jackals fail, the third and last step that the United States takes these days is to send in the military. It used to be the first step in building empire. Today it's the last step. We did that in 1990. Thought afterwards that we defeated Saddam's army and he'd been sufficiently chastised that now the economic hitmen could win him over. We couldn't. Had we won Saddam over, he would still be the head of state of that country, make no bones about it. And we would be selling him tanks and fighter planes and probably building him chemical plants, as we've done so many places that are ruled by dictators who have gone along with our system. Since he didn't come around, again in the 90s, we tried to assassinate him, couldn't. We sent him the military again.
No, actually, of course, we assisted him during the war with Iran. There is no inconsistency about this.
Ouch. Ooh, rough edit there. This is KPFT Houston. You've been listening to Takes on the World with Jeffrey Blankfort. My name is Scooter, and stay tuned next week in this time slot for Slave Revolt Radio. Cliff Smith coming up next with Songlines.
KPFT Houston is the community radio station in Houston. We deal with issues no one else will touch. We play music no one else plays. And the reason? We're the community radio station in Houston. Membership driven, we thrive on input from all our listeners. And this Sunday at Shape Center, we're having a town meeting so listeners and members alike will share their ideas.